This is Audible.
Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows by J.K. Rowling. Read by Jim Dale. An unabridged performance brought to you by Pottermore from J.K. Rowling.
Chapter 1. The Dark Lord Ascending. The two men appeared out of nowhere, a few yards apart in the narrow, moonlit lane. For a second, they stood quite still, wands directed at each other's chests. Then, recognizing each other, they stowed their wands beneath their cloaks and started walking briskly in the same direction.
"News?" asked the taller of the two.
"The best," replied Severus Snape. The lane was bordered on the left by wild, low-growing brambles, on the right by a high, neatly manicured hedge. The men's long cloaks flapped around their ankles as they marched.
"Thought I might be late," said Yaxley, his blunt features sliding in and out of sight as the branches of overhanging trees broke the moonlight. "It was a little trickier than I expected, but I hope he will be satisfied. You sound confident that your reception will be good."
Snape nodded, but did not elaborate. They turned right into a wide driveway that led off the lane. The high hedge curved with them, running off into the distance beyond the pair of impressive wrought-iron gates barring the men's way. Neither of them broke step. In silence, both raised their left arms in a kind of salute and passed straight through, as though the dark metal were smoke. The yew hedges muffled the sound of the men's footsteps. There was a rustle somewhere to their right. Yaxley drew his wand again, pointing it over his companion's head, but the source of the noise proved to be nothing more than a pure white peacock strutting majestically along the top of the hedge.
"He always did himself well, Lucius. Peacocks."
Yaxley thrust his wand back under his cloak with a snort. A handsome manor house grew out of the darkness at the end of the straight drive, lights glinting in the diamond-paned downstairs windows. Somewhere in the dark garden beyond the hedge, a fountain was playing. Gravel crackled beneath their feet as Snape and Yaxley sped toward the front door, which swung inward at their approach, though nobody had visibly opened it. The hallway was large, dimly lit, and sumptuously decorated, with a magnificent carpet covering most of the stone floor. The eyes of the pale-faced portraits on the walls followed Snape and Yaxley as they strode past. The two men halted at a heavy wooden door leading into the next room, hesitated for the space of a heartbeat, then Snape turned the bronze handle. The drawing room was full of silent people, sitting at a long and ornate table. The room's usual furniture had been pushed carelessly up against the walls. Illumination came from a roaring fire beneath a handsome marble mantelpiece surmounted by a gilded mirror. Snape and Yaxley lingered for a moment on the threshold. As their eyes grew accustomed to the lack of light, they were drawn upward to the strangest feature of the scene, an apparently unconscious human figure hanging upside down over the table, revolving slowly as if suspended by an invisible rope and reflected in the mirror and in the bare, polished surface of the table below. None of the people seated underneath this singular sight was looking at it except for a pale young man sitting almost directly below it. He seemed unable to prevent himself from glancing upward every minute or so.
"Yaxley! Snape!"
said a high, clear voice from the head of the table.
"You are very nearly late."
The speaker was seated directly in front of the fireplace, so that it was difficult, at first, for the new arrivals to make out more than his silhouette. As they drew nearer, however, his face shone through the gloom, hairless, snake-like, with slits for nostrils and gleaming red eyes whose pupils were vertical. He was so pale that he seemed to emit a pearly glow.
"Severus, here!"
said Voldemort, indicating the seat on his immediate right.
"Yaxley,
beside Dolohov.
The two men took their allotted places. Most of the eyes around the table followed Snape, and it was to him that Voldemort spoke first.
So?
My lord, the Order of the Phoenix intends to move Harry Potter from his current place of safety on Saturday next, at nightfall.
The interest around the table sharpened palpably. Some stiffened, others fidgeted, all gazing at Snape and Voldemort.
Saturday, at nightfall,
repeated Voldemort. His red eyes fastened upon Snape's black ones with such intensity that some of the watchers looked away, apparently fearful that they themselves would be scorched by the ferocity of the gaze. Snape, however, looked calmly back into Voldemort's face, and after a moment or two, Voldemort's lipless mouth curved into something like a smile.
Good. Very good. And this information comes
from the source we discussed, said Snape.
My lord?
Yaxley had leaned forward to look down the long table at Voldemort and Snape, all faces turned to him.
My lord, I have heard differently.
Yaxley waited, but Voldemort did not speak, so he went on.
Dawlish, the Auror, let slip that Potter will not be moved until the 30th, the night before the boy turns 17.
Snape was smiling.
My source told me that there are plans to lay a false trail. This must be it. No doubt a confundus charm has been placed upon Dawlish. It would not be the first time. He is known to be susceptible.
I assure you, my lord, Dawlish seemed quite certain,
said Yaxley.
If he has been confounded, naturally he is certain, said Snape. I assure you, Yaxley, the Auror office will play no further part in the protection of Harry Potter. The Order believes that we have infiltrated the Ministry.
The Order's got one thing right then, eh?
Said a squat man sitting a short distance from Yaxley. He gave a wheezy giggle that was echoed here and there along the table. Voldemort did not laugh. His gaze had wandered upward to the body revolving slowly overhead, and he seemed to be lost in thought.
My lord,
Yaxley went on,
Dawlish believes an entire party of Aurors will be used to transfer the boy.
Voldemort held up a large white hand, and Yaxley subsided at once, watching resentfully as Voldemort turned back to Snape.
Where are they going to hide the boy next?
At the home of one of the Order, said Snape. The place, according to the source, has been given every protection that the Order and Ministry together could provide. I think that there is little chance of taking him once he is there, my lord, unless, of course, the Ministry has fallen before next Saturday, which might give us the opportunity to discover and undo enough of the enchantments to break through the rest.
Well, Yaxley,
Voldemort called down the table, the firelight glinting strangely in his red eyes.
Will the Ministry have fallen by next Saturday?
Once again, all heads turned. Yaxley squared his shoulders.
My lord, I have good news on that score. I have, with difficulty and after great effort, succeeded in placing an imperious curse upon Pious Thickness.
Many of those sitting around Yaxley looked impressed. His neighbor, Dolohov, a man with a long, twisted face, clapped him on the back.
It is a start,
said Voldemort.
But Thickness is only one man. Scrimgeour must be surrounded by our people before I act. One failed attempt on the Minister's life will set me back a long way.
Yes, my lord, that is true. But, you know, as head of the Department of Magical Law Enforcement, Thickness has regular contact not only with the Minister himself, but also with the heads of all the other Ministry departments.
It will, I think, be easy now that we have such a high-ranking official under our control to subjugate the others, and then they can all work together to bring Scrimgeour down.
As long as our friend Thickness is not discovered before he has converted the rest, said Voldemort. At any rate, it remains unlikely that the Ministry will be mine before next Saturday. If we cannot touch the boy at his destination, then it must be done while he travels.
We are at an advantage there, my lord, said Yaxley, who seemed determined to receive some portion of approval. We now have several people planted within the Department of Magical Transport. If Potter apparates or uses the flu network, we shall know immediately.
He will not do either, said Snape. The Order is eschewing any form of transport that is controlled or regulated by the Ministry. They mistrust everything to do with the place. All the better, said Voldemort. He will have to move in the open. Easier to take by far.
Again, Voldemort looked up at the slowly revolving body as he went on.
I shall attend to the boy in person. There have been too many mistakes where Harry Potter is concerned. Some of them have been my own. That Potter lives is due more to my errors than to his triumphs.
The company around the table watched Voldemort apprehensively, each of them, by his or her expression, afraid that they might be blamed for Harry Potter's continued existence. Voldemort, however, seemed to be speaking more to himself than to any of them, still addressing the unconscious body above him.
I have been careless, and so have been thwarted by luck and chance, those wreckers of all but the best-laid plans. But I know better now. I understand those things that I did not understand before. I must be the one to kill Harry Potter. And I shall be.
At these words, seemingly in response to them, a sudden wail sounded, a terrible, drawn-out cry of misery and pain. Many of those at the table looked downward, startled, for the sound had seemed to issue from below their feet.
Wormtail, said Voldemort,
with no change in his quiet, thoughtful tone, and without removing his eyes from the revolving body above.
Have I not spoken to you about keeping our prisoner quiet? Yes, my lord,
gasped a small man halfway down the table, who had been sitting so low in his chair that it had appeared at first glance to be unoccupied. Now he scrambled from his seat and scurried from the room, leaving nothing behind him but a curious gleam of silver.
As I was saying,
continued Voldemort, looking again at the tense faces of his followers.
I understand better now. I shall need, for instance, to borrow a wand from one of you before I go to kill Potter.
The faces around him displayed nothing but shock. He might have announced that he wanted to borrow one of their arms.
No volunteers,
said Voldemort.
Let's see. Lucius, I see no reason for you to have a wand anymore.
Lucius Malfoy looked up. His skin appeared yellowish and waxy in the firelight, and his eyes were sunken and shadowed. When he spoke, his voice was hoarse.
My lord.
Your wand, Lucius. I require your wand.
Malfoy glanced sideways at his wife. She was staring straight ahead, quite as pale as he was, her long blonde hair hanging down her back. But beneath the table, her slim fingers closed briefly on his wrist. At her touch, Malfoy put his hand into his robes, withdrew a wand, and passed it along to Voldemort, who held it up in front of his red eyes, examining it closely.
What is it?
Helm, my lord, whispered Malfoy.
And the core?
Dragon. dragon heartstring.
Good, said Voldemort.
He drew out his own wand and compared the lengths. Lucius Malfoy made an involuntary movement. For a fraction of a second, it seemed he expected to receive Voldemort's wand in exchange for his own. The gesture was not missed by Voldemort, whose eyes widened maliciously.
Give you my wand, Lucius? My wand?
Some of the throng sniggered.
I have given you your liberty, Lucius. Is that not enough for you? But I have noticed that you and your family seem less than happy of late. What is it about my presence in your home that displeases you, Lucius?
Nothing. Nothing, my lord.
Such lies, Lucius.
The soft voice seemed to hiss on, even after the cruel mouth had stopped moving. One or two of the wizards barely repressed a shudder as the hissing grew louder. Something heavy could be heard sliding across the floor beneath the table. The huge snake emerged to climb slowly up Voldemort's chair. It rose seemingly endlessly and came to rest across Voldemort's shoulders, its neck the thickness of a man's thigh, its eyes with their vertical slits for pupils, unblinking. Voldemort stroked the creature absently with long, thin fingers, still looking at Lucius Malfoy.
Why do the Malfoys look so unhappy with their lot? Is my return, my rise to power, not the very thing they profess to desire for so many years?
Of course, my lord,
said Lucius Malfoy. His hands shook as he wiped sweat from his upper lip.
We did desire it. We do!
To Malfoy's left, his wife made an odd, stiff nod, her eyes averted from Voldemort and the snake. To his right, his son Draco, who had been gazing up at the inert body overhead, glanced quickly at Voldemort and away again, terrified to make eye contact.
My lord,
said a dark woman halfway down the table, her voice constricted with emotion.
It is an honor to have you here in our family's house. There can be no higher pleasure.
She sat beside her sister, as unlike her in looks, with her dark hair and heavily lidded eyes, as she was in bearing and demeanor. Where Narcissa sat rigid and impassive, Bellatrix leaned toward Voldemort, for mere words could not demonstrate her longing for closeness.
No higher pleasure,
repeated Voldemort, his head tilted a little to one side as he considered Bellatrix.
That means a great deal, Bellatrix, from you.
Her face flooded with color, her eyes welled with tears of delight.
My lord knows I speak nothing but the truth. No higher pleasure, even compared with the happy event that I hear has taken place in your family this week.
She stared at him, her lips parted, evidently confused.
I don't know what you mean, my lord. I'm talking about your niece, Bellatrix, and yours, Lucius and Narcissa. She has just married the werewolf, Remus Lupin. You must be so proud.
There was an eruption of jeering laughter from around the table. Many leaned forward to exchange gleeful looks. A few thumped the table with their fists. The great snake, disliking the disturbance, opened its mouth wide and hissed angrily. But the Death Eaters did not hear it, so jubilant were they at Bellatrix and the Malfoy's humiliation. Bellatrix's face, so recently flushed with happiness, had turned an ugly, blotchy red.
She is no niece of ours, my lord,
she cried over the outpouring of mirth.
We, Narcissa and I, have never set eyes on our sister since she married the Mudblood. This brat has nothing to do with either of us, nor any beast she marries. What say you, Draco?
Asked Voldemort, and though his voice was quiet, it carried clearly through the catcalls and jeers.
Will you babysit the cubs?
The hilarity mounted. Draco Malfoy looked in terror at his father, who was staring down into his own lap, then caught his mother's eye. She shook her head almost imperceptibly, then resumed her own deadpan stare at the opposite wall.
"Enough!"
said Voldemort, stroking the angry snake.
"Enough!"
And the laughter died at once.
"Many of our oldest family trees become a little disease over time,"
he said, as Bellatrix gazed at him, breathless and imploring.
"You must prune yours, must you not, to keep it healthy? Cut away those parts that threaten the health of the rest." "Yes, my lord,"
whispered Bellatrix, and her eyes swam with tears of gratitude again.
"At the first chance, you shall have it," said Voldemort, "and in your family, so in the world. We shall cut away the canker that infects us until only those of the true blood remain."
Voldemort raised Lucius Malfoy's wand, pointed it directly at the slowly revolving figure suspended over the table, and gave it a tiny flick. The figure came to life with a groan and began to struggle against invisible bonds.
"Do you recognize our guest, Severus?"
asked Voldemort. Snape raised his eyes to the upside-down face. All of the Death Eaters were looking up at the captive now, as though they had been given permission to show curiosity. As she revolved to face the firelight, the woman said in a cracked and terrified voice,
"Severus, help me!"
"Ah, yes," said Snape, as the prisoner turned slowly away again.
"And you, Draco?"
asked Voldemort, stroking the snake's snout with his wand free hand. Draco shook his head jerkily. Now that the woman had woken, he seemed unable to look at her any more.
"But you would not have taken her classes," said Voldemort. "For those of you who do not know, we are joined here tonight by Charity Burbage, who, until recently, taught at Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry."
There were small noises of comprehension around the table. A broad, hunched woman with pointed teeth cackled.
"Yes, Professor Burbage taught the children of witches and wizards all about muggles, how they are not so different from us."
One of the Death Eaters spat on the floor. Charity Burbage revolved to face Snape again.
"Severus, please, please, silence,"
said Voldemort with another twitch of Malfoy's wand. And Charity fell silent as if gagged.
"Not content with corrupting and polluting the minds of wizarding children, last week Professor Burbage wrote an impassioned defense of mudbloods in the Daily Prophet. Wizards, she says, must accept these thieves of their knowledge and magic. The dwindling of the purebloods is, says Professor Burbage, a most desirable circumstance. She would have us all mate with muggles, or, no doubt, werewolves."
Nobody laughed this time. There was no mistaking the anger and contempt in Voldemort's voice. For the third time, Charity Burbage revolved to face Snape. Tears were pouring from her eyes into her hair. Snape looked back at her, quite impassive, as she turned slowly away from him again.
"Avada Kedavra!"
The flash of green light illuminated every corner of the room. Charity fell with a resounding crash onto the table below, which trembled and creaked. Several of the Death Eaters leapt back in their chairs. Draco fell out of his onto the floor.
"Dinner, Nagini,"
said Voldemort softly, and the great snake swayed and slithered from his shoulders onto the polished wood. Chapter 2 In Memoriam. Harry was bleeding. Clutching his right hand in his left and swearing under his breath, he shouldered open his bedroom door. There was a crunch of breaking china. He had trodden on a cup of cold tea that had been sitting on the floor outside his bedroom door.
What the...
He looked around. The landing of number 4 Privet Drive was deserted. Possibly the cup of tea was Dudley's idea of a clever booby trap. Keeping his bleeding hand elevated, Harry scraped the fragments of cup together with the other hand and threw them into the already crammed bin, just visible inside his bedroom door. Then he tramped across to the bathroom to run his finger under the tap. It was stupid, pointless, irritating beyond belief that he still had 4 days left of being unable to perform magic. But he had to admit to himself that this jagged cut in his finger would have defeated him. He had never learned how to repair wounds, and now he came to think of it, particularly in light of his immediate plans, this seemed a serious flaw in his magical education. Making a mental note to ask Hermione how it was done, he used a large wad of toilet paper to mop up as much of the tea as he could, before returning to his bedroom and slamming the door behind him. Harry had spent the morning completely emptying his school trunk for the first time since he had packed it 6 years ago. At the start of the intervening school years, he had merely skimmed off the topmost 3/4 of the contents and replaced or updated them, leaving a layer of general debris at the bottom. Old quills, desiccated beetle eyes, single socks that no longer fit. Minutes previously, Harry had plunged his hand into this mulch, experienced a stabbing pain in the 4th finger of his right hand, and withdrawn it to see a lot of blood. He now proceeded a little more cautiously. Kneeling down beside the trunk again, he groped around in the bottom, and, after retrieving an old badge that flickered feebly between Support Cedric Diggory and Potter Stinks, a cracked and worn-out sneaker scope, and a gold locket inside which a note signed R.A.B. had been hidden, he finally discovered the sharp edge that had done the damage. He recognized it at once. It was a 2-inch-long fragment of the enchanted mirror that his dead godfather Sirius had given him. Harry laid it aside and felt cautiously around the trunk for the rest, but nothing more remained of his godfather's last gift except powdered glass, which clung to the deepest layer of debris like glittering grit. Harry sat up and examined the jagged piece on which he had cut himself, seeing nothing but his own bright green eye reflected back at him. Then he placed the fragment on top of that morning's Daily Prophet, which lay unread on the bed, and attempted to stem the sudden upsurge of bitter memories, the stabs of regret and of longing the discovery of the broken mirror had occasioned, by attacking the rest of the rubbish in the trunk. It took another hour to empty it completely, throw away the useless items, and sort the remainder in piles according to whether or not he would need them from now on. His school and Quidditch robes, cauldron, parchment, quills, and most of his textbooks were piled in a corner to be left behind. He wondered what his aunt and uncle would do with them. Burn them in the dead of night, probably, as if they were the evidence of some dreadful crime. His muggle clothing, invisibility cloak, potion-making kit, certain books, the photograph album Hagrid had once given him, a stack of letters, and his wand, had been repacked into an old rucksack. In a front pocket were the Marauder's map and the locket with the note signed R.A.B. inside it. The locket was accorded this place of honor not because it was valuable. In all usual senses it was worthless, but because of what it had cost to attain it. This left a sizable stack of newspapers sitting on his desk beside his snowy owl Hedwig. One for each of the days Harry had spent at Privet Drive this summer. He got up off the floor, stretched, and moved across to his desk. Hedwig made no movement as he began to flick through the newspapers, throwing them onto the rubbish pile one by one. The owl was asleep, or else faking. She was angry with Harry about the limited amount of time she was allowed out of her cage at the moment. As he neared the bottom of the pile of newspapers, Harry slowed down, searching for one particular issue that he knew had arrived shortly after he had returned to Privet Drive for the summer. He remembered that there had been a small mention on the front about the resignation of Charity Burbage, the Muggles' studies teacher at Hogwarts. At last, he found it. Turning to page 10, he sank into his desk chair and reread the article he had been looking for. Albus Dumbledore Remembered, by Elpheus Doge. I met Albus Dumbledore at the age of 11, on our first day at Hogwarts. Our mutual attraction was undoubtedly due to the fact that we both felt ourselves to be outsiders. I had contracted dragon pox shortly before arriving at school, and while I was no longer contagious, my pockmarked visage and greenish hue did not encourage many to approach me. For his part, Albus had arrived at Hogwarts under the burden of unwanted notoriety. Scarcely a year previously, his father, Percival, had been convicted of a savage and well-publicized attack upon three young Muggles. Albus never attempted to deny that his father, who was to die in Azkaban, had committed this crime. On the contrary, when I plucked up courage to ask him, he assured me that he knew his father to be guilty. Beyond that, Dumbledore refused to speak of the sad business, though many attempted to make him do so. Some, indeed, were disposed to praise his father's action, and assumed that Albus, too, was a Muggle-hater. They could not have been more mistaken. As anybody who knew Albus would attest, he never revealed the remotest anti-Muggle tendency. Indeed, his determined support for Muggle rights gained him many enemies in subsequent years. In a matter of months, however, Albus's own fame had begun to eclipse that of his father. By the end of his first year, he would never again be known as the son of a Muggle-hater, but as nothing more or less than the most brilliant student ever seen at the school. Those of us who were privileged to be his friends benefited from his example, not to mention his help and encouragement, with which he was always generous. He confessed to me in later life that he knew even then that his greatest pleasure lay in teaching. He not only won every prize of note that the school offered, he was soon in regular correspondence with the most notable magical names of the day, including Nicholas Flamel, the celebrated alchemist, Matilda Bagshot, the noted historian, and Adalbert Waffling, the magical theoretician. Several of his papers found their way into learned publications, such as Transfiguration Today, Challenges in Charming, and The Practical Potioneer. Dumbledore's future career seemed likely to be meteoric, and the only question that remained was when he would become Minister of Magic. Though it was often predicted in later years that he was on the point of taking the job, however, he never had ministerial ambitions. 3 years after we had started at Hogwarts, Albus's brother, Aberforth, arrived at school. They were not alike. Aberforth was never bookish and, unlike Albus, preferred to settle arguments by dueling rather than through reasoned discussion. However, it is quite wrong to suggest, as some have, that the brothers were not friends. They rubbed along as comfortably as two such different boys could do. In fairness to Aberforth, it must be admitted that living in Albus's shadow cannot have been an altogether comfortable experience. Being continually outshone was an occupational hazard of being his friend, and cannot have been any more pleasurable as a brother. When Albus and I left Hogwarts, we intended to take the then-traditional tour of the world together, visiting and observing foreign wizards before pursuing our separate careers. However, tragedy intervened. On the very eve of our trip, Albus's mother, Kendra, died, leaving Albus the head and sole breadwinner of the family. I postponed my departure long enough to pay my respects at Kendra's funeral, then left for what was now to be a solitary journey. With a younger brother and sister to care for, and little gold left to them, there could no longer be any question of Albus accompanying me. That was the period of our lives when we had least contact. I wrote to Albus, describing, perhaps insensitively, the wonders of my journey, from narrow escapes from chimeras in Greece to the experiments of the Egyptian alchemists. His letters told me little of his day-to-day life, which I guessed to be frustratingly dull for such a brilliant wizard. Immersed in my own experiences, it was with horror that I heard, toward the end of my year's travels, that yet another tragedy had struck the Dumbledores. the death of his sister, Ariana. Though Ariana had been in poor health for a long time, the blow, coming so soon after the loss of their mother, had a profound effect on both of her brothers. All those closest to Albus, and I count myself one of that lucky number, agree that Ariana's death and Albus's feeling of personal responsibility for it, though of course he was guiltless, left their mark upon him forevermore. I returned home to find a young man who had experienced a much older person's suffering. Albus was more reserved than before, and much less light-hearted. To add to his misery, the loss of Ariana had led not to a renewed closeness between Albus and Aberforth, but to an estrangement. In time this would lift. In later years they re-established, if not a close relationship, then certainly a cordial one. However, he rarely spoke of his parents or of Ariana from then on, and his friends learned not to mention them. Other quills will describe the triumphs of the following years. Dumbledore's innumerable contributions to the store of wizarding knowledge, including his discovery of the 12 uses of dragon's blood, will benefit generations to come, as will the wisdom he displayed in the many judgments he made while chief warlock of the Wizengamot. They say still that no wizarding duel ever matched that between Dumbledore and Grindelwald in 1945. Those who witness it have written of the terror and the awe they felt as they watched these two extraordinary wizards do battle. Dumbledore's triumph and its consequences for the wizarding world are considered a turning point in magical history to match the introduction of the International Statute of Secrecy or the downfall of He Who Must Not Be Named. Albus Dumbledore was never proud or vain. He could find something to value in anyone, however apparently insignificant or wretched, and I believe that his early losses endowed him with great humanity and sympathy. I shall miss his friendship more than I can say, but my loss is as nothing compared to the wizarding world's. That he was the most inspiring and the best loved of all Hogwarts headmasters cannot be in question. He died as he lived, working always for the greater good, and, to his last hour, as willing to stretch out a hand to a small boy with dragonpox as he was on the day that I met him. Harry finished reading, but continued to gaze at the picture accompanying the obituary. Dumbledore was wearing his familiar, kindly smile, but as he peered over the top of his half-moon spectacles, he gave the impression, even in newsprint, of X-raying Harry, whose sadness mingled with a sense of humiliation. He had thought he knew Dumbledore quite well, but ever since reading this obituary he had been forced to recognize that he had barely known him at all. Never once had he imagined Dumbledore's childhood or youth. It was as though he had sprung into being as Harry had known him, venerable and silver-haired and old. The idea of a teenage Dumbledore was simply odd, like trying to imagine a stupid Hermione or a friendly blast-ended Scroote. He had never thought to ask Dumbledore about his past. No doubt it would have felt strange, impertinent even, but after all, it had been common knowledge that Dumbledore had taken part in that legendary duel with Grindelwald, and Harry had not thought to ask Dumbledore what that had been like, nor about any of his other famous achievements. No, they had always discussed Harry, Harry's past, Harry's future, Harry's plans, and it seemed to Harry now, despite the fact that his future was so dangerous and so uncertain, that he had missed irreplaceable opportunities when he had failed to ask Dumbledore more about himself, even though the only personal question he had ever asked his headmaster was also the only one he suspected that Dumbledore had not answered honestly. "What do you see when you look in the mirror?"
I see myself holding a pair of thick woolen socks."
After several minutes' thought, Harry tore the obituary out of the Prophet, folded it carefully, and tucked it inside the first volume of Practical Defensive Magic and Its Use Against the Dark Arts. Then he threw the rest of the newspaper onto the rubbish pile and turned to face the room. It was much tidier. The only things left out of place were today's Daily Prophet, still lying on the bed, and on top of it, the piece of broken mirror. Harry moved across the room, slid the mirror fragment off today's prophet, and unfolded the newspaper. He had merely glanced at the headline when he had taken the rolled-up paper from the delivery owl early that morning and thrown it aside, after noting that it said nothing about Voldemort. Harry was sure that the Ministry was leaning on the prophet to suppress news about Voldemort. It was only now, therefore, that he saw what he had missed. Across the bottom half of the front page, a smaller headline was set over a picture of Dumbledore striding along, looking harried. Dumbledore, the truth at last? Coming next week, the shocking story of the flawed genius considered by many to be the greatest wizard of his generation. Stripping away the popular image of serene, silver-bearded wisdom, Rita Skeeter reveals the disturbed childhood, the lawless youth, the lifelong feuds, and the guilty secrets that Dumbledore carried to his grave. Why was the man, tipped to be Minister of Magic, content to remain a mere headmaster? What was the real purpose of the secret organization known as the Order of the Phoenix? How did Dumbledore really meet his end? The answers to these and many more questions are explored in the explosive new biography, The Life and Lies of Albus Dumbledore, by Rita Skeeter, exclusively interviewed by Betty Braithwaite, page 13, inside. Harry ripped open the paper and found page 13. The article was topped with a picture showing another familiar face. A woman wearing jeweled glasses with elaborately curled blonde hair, her teeth bared in what was clearly supposed to be a winning smile, wiggling her fingers up at him. Doing his best to ignore this nauseating image, Harry read on. In person, Rita Skeeter is much warmer and softer than her famously ferocious quill portraits might suggest. Greeting me in the hallway of her cozy home, she leads me straight into the kitchen for a cup of tea, a slice of pound cake and, it goes without saying, a steaming vat of freshest gossip. "Well, of course, Dumbledore is a biographer's dream," says Skeeter. "Such a long, full life. I'm sure my book will be the first of very, very many." Skeeter was certainly quick off the mark. Her 900-page book was completed a mere 4 weeks after Dumbledore's mysterious death in June. I ask her how she managed this super-fast feat. "Oh, when you've been a journalist as long as I have, working to a deadline is second nature. I knew that the wizarding world was clamoring for the full story, and I wanted to be the first to meet that need." I mentioned the recent widely publicized remarks of Elpheus Doge, special advisor to the Wizengamot, and long-standing friend of Albus Dumbledore's, that Skeeter's book contains less fact than a chocolate frog card. Skeeter throws back her head and laughs. "Darling Dodgy. I remember interviewing him a few years back about merpeople rights, bless him. Completely gaga. Seemed to think we were sitting at the bottom of Lake Windermere. Kept telling me to watch out for trout." And yet, Elpheus Doge's accusations of inaccuracy have been echoed in many places. Does Skeeter really feel that 4 short weeks have been enough to gain a full picture of Dumbledore's long and extraordinary life? "Oh, my dear," beams Skeeter, rapping me affectionately across the knuckles, "you know as well as I do how much information can be generated by a fat bag of galleons, a refusal to hear the word no, and a nice sharp quick quotes quill. People were queuing to dish the dirt on Dumbledore anyway. Not everyone thought he was so wonderful, you know. He trod on an awful lot of important toes. But old Dodgy Doge can get off his high hippogriff, because I've had access to a source most journalists would swap their wands for, one who has never spoken in public before and who was close to Dumbledore during the most turbulent and disturbing phase of his youth." The advance publicity for Skeeter's biography has certainly suggested that there will be shocks in store for those who believe Dumbledore to have led a blameless life. "What were the biggest surprises she uncovered?" I ask. "Now, come off it, Betty. I'm not giving away all the highlights before anybody's bought the book," laughs Skeeter. "But I can promise that anybody who still thinks Dumbledore was white as his beard is in for a rude awakening. Let's just say that nobody hearing him rage against you-know-who would have dreamed that he dabbled in the dark arts himself in his youth, And for a wizard who spent his later years pleading for tolerance, he wasn't exactly broad-minded when he was younger. Yes, Albus Dumbledore had an extremely murky past, not to mention that very fishy family which he worked so hard to keep hushed up. I ask whether Skeeter is referring to Dumbledore's brother, Aberforth, whose conviction by the Wizengamot for misuse of magic caused a minor scandal 15 years ago. "Oh, Aberforth is just the tip of the dung heap," laughed Skeeter. "No, no, I'm talking about much worse than a brother with a fondness for fiddling about with goats. Worse even than the muggle-maiming father. Dumbledore couldn't keep either of them quiet anyway. They were both charged by the Wizengamot. No, it's the mother and the sister that intrigued me. And a little digging uncovered a positive nest of nastiness. But, as I say, you'll have to wait for chapters 9 to 12 for full details. All I can say now is, it's no wonder Dumbledore never talked about how his nose got broken. Family skeletons notwithstanding, does Skeeter deny the brilliance that led to Dumbledore's many magical discoveries? He had brains, she concedes, although many now question whether he could really take full credit for all of his supposed achievements. As I reveal in Chapter 16, Ivor Dillonsby claims he had already discovered 8 uses of dragon's blood when Dumbledore borrowed his papers. But the importance of some of Dumbledore's achievements cannot, I venture, be denied. What of his famous defeat of Grindelwald? "Oh, now I'm glad you mentioned Grindelwald," says Skeeter with a tantalizing smile. "I'm afraid those who go dewy-eyed over Dumbledore's spectacular victory must brace themselves for a bombshell, or perhaps a dung bomb. Very dirty business indeed. All I'll say is, don't be so sure that there really was the spectacular duel of legend. After they've read my book, people may be forced to conclude that Grindelwald simply conjured a white handkerchief from the end of his wand and came quietly." Skeeter refuses to give any more away on this intriguing subject, so we turn instead to the relationship that will undoubtedly fascinate her readers more than any other. "Oh, yes," says Skeeter, nodding briskly. "I devote an entire chapter to the whole Potter-Dumbledore relationship. It's been called unhealthy, even sinister. Again, your readers will have to buy my book for the whole story, but there is no question that Dumbledore took an unnatural interest in Potter from the word go. Whether that was really in the boy's best interests, well, we'll see. It's certainly an open secret that Potter has had a most troubled adolescence." I ask whether Skeeter is still in touch with Harry Potter, whom she so famously interviewed last year. A breakthrough piece in which Potter spoke exclusively of his conviction that you-know-who had returned. "Oh, yes, we've developed a close bond," says Skeeter. "Poor Potter has few real friends, and we met at one of the most testing moments of his life, the Tri-Wizard Tournament. I am probably one of the only people alive who can say that they know the real Harry Potter." Which leads us neatly to the many rumours still circulating about Dumbledore's final hours. Does Skeeter believe that Potter was there when Dumbledore died? "Well, I don't want to say too much. It's all in the book. But eyewitnesses inside Hogwarts Castle saw Potter running away from the scene moments after Dumbledore fell, jumped, or was pushed. Potter later gave evidence against Severus Snape, a man against whom he has a notorious grudge. Is everything as it seems? That is for the wizarding community to decide, once they've read my book. On that intriguing note, I take my leave. There can be no doubt that Skeeter has quilled an instant bestseller. Dumbledore's legions of admirers, meanwhile, may well be trembling at what is soon to emerge about their hero. Harry reached the bottom of the article, but continued to stare blankly at the page. Revulsion and fury rose in him like vomit. He balled up the newspaper and threw it with all his force at the wall, where it joined the rest of the rubbish heaped around his overflowing bin. He began to stride blindly around the room, opening empty drawers and picking up books, only to replace them on the same piles, barely conscious of what he was doing, as random phrases from Rita's article echoed in his head. An entire chapter to the whole Potter-Dumbledore relationship. It's been called unhealthy, even sinister. He dabbled in the dark arts himself in his youth. I've had access to a source most journalists would swap their ones for.
Lies!
Harry bellowed, and through the window he saw the next-door neighbor, who had paused to restart his lawnmower, look up nervously. Harry sat down hard on the bed. The broken bit of mirror danced away from him. He picked it up and turned it over in his fingers, thinking. Thinking of Dumbledore, and the lies with which Rita Skeeter was defaming him. A flash of brightest blue. Harry froze, his cut finger slipping on the jagged edge of the mirror again. He had imagined it, he must have done. He glanced over his shoulder, but the wall was a sickly peach color of Aunt Petunia's choosing. There was nothing blue there for the mirror to reflect. He peered into the mirror fragment again, and saw nothing but his own bright green eye looking back at him. He had imagined it. There was no other explanation. Imagined it, because he had been thinking of his dead headmaster. If anything was certain, it was that the bright blue eyes of Albus Dumbledore would never pierce him again. Chapter 3. The Dursleys Departing. The sound of the front door slamming echoed up the stairs, and a voice yelled,
"Oi, you!"
16 years of being addressed thus left Harry in no doubt whom his uncle was calling. Nevertheless, he did not immediately respond. He was still gazing at the mirror fragment in which, for a split second, he had thought he saw Dumbledore's eye. It was not until his uncle bellowed,
"Boy!"
that Harry got slowly to his feet and headed for the bedroom door, pausing to add the piece of broken mirror to the rucksack filled with things he would be taking with him.
"You took your time,"
roared Vernon Dursley when Harry appeared at the top of the stairs.
"Get down here. I want a word."
Harry strolled downstairs, his hands deep in his jeans pockets. When he reached the living room, he found all three Dursleys. They were dressed for traveling. Uncle Vernon in a fawn zip-up jacket, Aunt Petunia in a neat salmon-coloured coat, and Dudley, Harry's large, blonde, muscular cousin, in his leather jacket. "Yes?" asked Harry.
"Sit down,"
said Uncle Vernon. Harry raised his eyebrows.
"Please,"
added Uncle Vernon, wincing slightly as though the word was sharp in his throat. Harry sat. He thought he knew what was coming. His uncle began to pace up and down, Aunt Petunia and Dudley following his movements with anxious expressions. Finally, his large purple face crumpled with concentration, Uncle Vernon stopped in front of Harry and spoke.
"I've changed my mind," he said.
"What a surprise," said Harry.
"Don't you take that tone,"
began Aunt Petunia in a shrill voice, but Vernon Dursley waved her down.
"It's all a lot of claptrap,"
said Uncle Vernon, glaring at Harry with piggy little eyes.
"I've decided I don't believe a word of it. We're staying put. We're not going anywhere."
Harry looked up at his uncle and felt a mixture of exasperation and amusement. Vernon Dursley had been changing his mind every 24 hours for the past 4 weeks, packing and unpacking and repacking the car with every change of heart. Harry's favourite moment had been the one when Uncle Vernon, unaware that Dudley had added his dumbbells to his case since the last time it had been unpacked, had attempted to hoist it back into the boot and collapsed with roars of pain and much swearing.
"According to you,"
Vernon Dursley said now, resuming his pacing up and down the living room,
"we, Petunia, Dudley and I, are in danger from
some of my lot. Right?" said Harry.
"Well, I don't believe it,"
repeated Uncle Vernon, coming to a halt in front of Harry again.
"I was awake half the night thinking it all over, and I believe it's a plot to get the house."
"The house?" repeated Harry. "What house?"
"This house,"
shrieked Uncle Vernon, the vein in his forehead starting to pulse.
"Our house! House prices are skyrocketing around here. You want us out of the way, and then you're going to do a bit of hocus-pocus, and before we know it, the deeds will be in your name, and..."
"Are you out of your mind?" demanded Harry.
a plot to get this house? Are you actually as stupid as you look?
Don't you dare,
squealed Aunt Petunia. But again Vernon waved her down. Slights on his personal appearance were, it seemed, as nothing to the danger he had spotted.
Just in case you've forgotten, said Harry, I've already got a house. My godfather left me one, so why should I want this one? All the happy memories?
There was silence. Harry thought he had rather impressed his uncle with this argument.
You claim, said Uncle Vernon, starting to pace yet again, that this Lord thing...
Voldemort, said Harry impatiently. And we've been through this about 100 times already. This isn't a claim, it's fact. Dumbledore told you last year, and Kingsley and Mr. Weasley. Vernon Dursley hunched his shoulders angrily, and Harry guessed that his uncle was attempting to ward off recollections of the unannounced visit, a few days into Harry's summer holidays, of two fully grown wizards. The arrival on the doorstep of Kingsley Shacklebolt and Arthur Weasley had come as a most unpleasant shock to the Dursleys. Harry had to admit, however, that as Mr. Weasley had once demolished half of the living room, his reappearance could not have been expected to delight Uncle Vernon.
Kingsley and Mr. Weasley explained it all as well, Harry pressed on remorselessly. Once I'm 17, the protective charm that keeps me safe will break, and that exposes you as well as me. The Order is sure Voldemort will target you, whether to torture you to try and find out where I am, or because he thinks by holding you hostage, I'd come and try to rescue you.
Uncle Vernon's and Harry's eyes met. Harry was sure that in that instant they were both wondering the same thing. Then Uncle Vernon walked on, and Harry resumed.
You've got to go into hiding, and the Order wants to help. You're being offered serious protection, the best there is.
Uncle Vernon said nothing, but continued to pace up and down. Outside, the sun hung low over the privet hedges. The next-door neighbor's lawnmower stalled again.
I thought there was a Ministry of Magic, asked Vernon Dursley abruptly.
There is, said Harry, surprised.
Well then, why can't they protect us? It seems to me that as innocent victims, guilty of nothing more than harbouring a marked man, we ought to qualify for government protection.
Harry laughed. He could not help himself. It was so very typical of his uncle to put his hopes in the establishment, even within this world that he despised and mistrusted.
You heard what Mr. Weasley and Kingsley said, Harry replied. We think the Ministry has been infiltrated.
Uncle Vernon strode to the fireplace and back, breathing so heavily that his great black moustache rippled, his face still purple with concentration.
All right,
he said, stopping in front of Harry yet again.
All right, let's say for the sake of argument we accept this protection. I still don't see why we can't have that Kingsley bloke.
Harry managed not to roll his eyes, but with difficulty. This question had also been addressed half a dozen times.
As I've told you, he said through gritted teeth, Kingsley is protecting the your Prime Minister.
Exactly.
He's the best, said Uncle Vernon, pointing at the blank television screen.
The Dursleys had spotted Kingsley on the news, walking along discreetly behind the Muggle Prime Minister as he visited a hospital. This, and the fact that Kingsley had mastered the knack of dressing like a Muggle, not to mention a certain reassuring something in his slow, deep voice, had caused the Dursleys to take to Kingsley in a way that they had certainly not done with any other wizard, although it was true that they had never seen him with his earring in.
Well, he's taken, said Harry. But Hestia Jones and Daedalus Diggle are more than up to the job.
If we'd ever seen CVs, began Uncle Vernon,
but Harry lost patience. Getting to his feet, he advanced on his uncle, now pointing at the TV set himself.
These accidents aren't accidents. The crashes and explosions and derailments and whatever else has happened since we last watched the news. People are disappearing and dying, and he's behind it. Voldemort. I've told you this over and over again. He kills Muggles for fun. Even the fogs. They're caused by Dementors, and if you can't remember what they are, ask your son.
Dudley's hands jerked upward to cover his mouth. With his parents and Harry's eyes upon him, He slowly lowered them again and asked,
"There are more of them?"
"More?" laughed Harry.
"More than the two that attacked us, you mean? Of course there are. There are hundreds."